happening at the level, at the CDC level, at the national level, and with our reporting requirements for CDC. In a couple of seconds, Dr. Keitlinger will highlight those changes briefly and walk through them, but I have a couple of additional comments. The Department of Health held a public hearing on June 17th in which no members of the public appeared. The changes were also publicized on our EPI listserv, which reaches approximately 630 recipients across the state, and that's basically primarily healthcare providers. For purposes of today's discussion, I thought it might be helpful to just very quickly define the difference between latent TB infection and active TB disease. Latent TB infection is when TB germs get into the body and they're sleeping. The sleeping germs don't hurt anyone or make them sick. They will test positive on a TB skin test, but they are not infectious. Active TB disease is when the germs are awake in your body and they start to grow and you become ill. These patients are sick, they cough, they're losing weight, they have poor appetite, and they are infectious to others. Back to our discussion about LTBI. As you'll notice in the written comments that we received from Don Tomek at Avera McKinnon, the Department of Health staff have had some follow-up discussions to clarify the rule changes specifically related to the reporting of LTBI. The proposed rule changes will change from reporting of all LTBI to reporting only those that are defined as high risk, and Dr. Keitlinger will provide that information to you shortly. Program discussions began about a year ago regarding bringing South Dakota in line with our national guidelines and reporting. And South Dakota was one of only two states who were continuing to report LTBIs to their state health department. In addition to aligning South Dakota reporting with national reporting, the department is responsible to direct our limited resources for public health towards efforts with the greatest public health impact. The plan to discontinue reporting and follow-up of LTBI was timely in that although the funds used for LTBI reporting could easily have been redirected to follow up on other infectious diseases, the general fund reduction in this area became a part of our overall 2012, our overall budget reduction for general funds. The department will continue to require reporting of high-risk LTBI patients, and we will provide case management and treatment if indicated. We'll continue to conduct contact investigations and to find and case manage those persons who are exposed to all the active cases. We will continue to work with our healthcare providers to help them manage these patients that have both that have active TB, and we will also be working with them to develop some tools that will make it easier for them to manage these cases through their practices. In addition, our staff are always available for consultation to any healthcare provider who has questions about managing infectious diseases. We have been working with our medical consultant and other healthcare providers who consult with the TB prevention and control program and how to best get this information out to all of our providers and have a plan developed to do so. The department has had follow-up conversations with both Sanford and Avera Health Systems in follow-up to their questions, and Avera has committed to working with the department to implement these changes. The department has also had discussions with the Sanford staff and administration who have said that they can support the proposed changes. Having said that, I will turn over to Dr. Keitlinger for a short review on the highlights of the changes.
Good morning. Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, please see in your packet the enclosure titled Communicable Disease Control. It's 4420. First of all, in Chapter 4420.01, Section 01 is the definition of terms. And what we are adding there is a definition to CD4 lymphocyte counts. And that's a blood test indicating the stage of HIV/AIDS patient infection, and that's on page 2 of the rules update. And similarly, on page 11, and this is definition number 50, is a definition of viral loads, which is how HIV quantity is measured in the blood. And then regarding the change in latent tuberculosis reporting, I refer you to page 10, to definition 48, and we define tuberculosis latent infection in high-risk persons. and high-risk persons include any foreign-born persons who entered the United States within the past 5 years, any contact to infectious tuberculosis, any diabetic, any person on renal dialysis, any person on tumor necrosis factor alpha therapy, any person on other immunosuppressive therapies such as high-dose steroids, persons with radiologic evidence of prior tuberculosis, children less than 5 years of age, anyone with HIV infection, any organ transplant recipient, any person with silicosis, any person with head and neck cancers, any person with leukemia or Hodgkin's disease. Then I refer you to the meat of our updates, and that's starting on page 11, and this is 4420, 01, 03, and 04. And this is, these are the lists of the Category 1 and Category 2 diseases. Category 1 diseases start on page 11, and the Category 2 diseases start on page 13. The rules will add two diseases to the list and cut 13 diseases. The new additions will be anaplasmosis and non-paralytic polio. We also make, not adding a new disease to the list, but just adding a new reporting criteria, which are the CD4 counts and viral loads and pregnancy to HIV cases. And then from the list we are cutting, ricin, toxin, drug-resistant strep pneumoniae, Ypsilon toxin, Glanders disease, hepatitis D and E, herpes simplex infections, melioidosis, Nipah virus, Staph B enterotoxin, Streptococcus A and Streptococcus B diseases, and typhus infections. We are making, and we're also modifying the reporting of latent TB infection with Colleen, which Colleen just discussed to you. And this is not cutting it, but just limiting it to people with who are at high risk. And the reasons for making these changes to the existing rules is to update our list to bring it into compliance with the National Disease Reporting List, streamline the disease control recommendations, and to modernize the disease surveillance needs for South Dakota. And I direct you to the bottom of page 17, to section 4420.01.03, and this lists the infectious diseases for submission to the State Public Health Laboratory. And there are two viral diseases and 15 bacterial diseases on that list, which are already on the reportable disease list. And other changes are housekeeping in nature, such as updating vocabulary and scientific references. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further comments by the department?
No, that's all. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Valley.
Just a couple quick questions. One, on tuberculosis, you were talking about latent and active, I think, tuberculosis. How do you, what triggers? I mean, can you have latent tuberculosis and all of a sudden it becomes active and no one knows about it? How can you explain that?
You can have latent tuberculosis and it becomes active. Approximately 10% of latent cases can become active. Those patients would start to show symptoms and would more than likely be seen by their healthcare provider for symptoms.
A follow-up?
Go ahead.
Is the person then that goes from latent to active contagious then at that point?
Once you're active, you are infectious, yes. Dr. Keitlinger, did you have another comment?
The people with the propensity to go from latent to active would be primarily the high-risk people who we are keeping in the rule. So we're targeting the high-risk people who are at highest risk.
So in other words, the chances of someone having tuberculosis and spreading it is still very, very narrow, because the high-risk people are the ones that would go to life after this epidemic.
And we are going to continue to monitor those high-risk patients based on that list that Dr. Kettlinger shared with you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair?
Go ahead, Representative Torno.
Thank you. If it's all right with you, Madam Chair, I've got about three questions. Is that all right, just to go with all of them?
Yes.
All right. And I'm not sure who this is for, but I'm looking at page 19, 4420-0201. I see that you proposed to add that this can be communicated by physicians electronically. And that they can do so within 3 days after recognition or strong suspicion of disease. My questions are, do you have concerns if they're doing that electronically with the privacy issues? And secondly, why do we say there that it's, if they have the recognition or strong suspicion of the disease, but yet two lines up you had taken that same language out? Why is that?
The electronic reporting is done by secure internet connections. They're either entered case by case by the physician, or they're done by electronic lab reporting. There's no actual person entering the data, but rather the data is just exchanged between the laboratory of the reporting facility and our surveillance computer. And
your question about category one diseases, could you repeat that again, the question about the day of recognition?
Well, it actually has the category two diseases. You say that can be reportable within 3 days after recognition or strong suspicion of disease, but two lines up as to category one, you took out that same language.
Well,
on the day of recognition or strong suspicion of disease, why?
The reason for taking that out was we had immediately in there, and we felt immediately meant immediately, right away, now. So it was redundant to say on the day of recognition, because immediately means as soon as you know it. Whereas within 3 days, we don't have any other modifiers in there. It's just within 3 days.
But then go to page 20, and my question again is this electronic transmission. Why would we not allow hospitals or laboratories to do it electronically? Why didn't we have that same language as you have in 0201?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry. I'm assuming that they probably already submit electronically.
Yes, yes, they already do. So,
it's a good point, though.
Then I think in the future. Last question. It kind of follows up from one. I guess I had concerns about. Go to page 24. And this is, this is dealing with methods of reporting under 0206. It says that these things can be reported by the secure, confidential website, and then it lists now the new website. How do we know that that's confidential? And as a follow-up under that sub 5, sub 6 says, sub 6 says these emails can be to a secure application server. How would somebody know that they're sending them to a secure application server?
This is not
a
website.
No.
In response to your first question, this is not a new website. It's the disease reporting website that we have been using. I believe it's just underlined because it's a website. We do work with our IT folks here in state government.
This is Dan Patient in Huron, Department of Labor Office.
I'm sorry. We do work with our IT staff to assure that we have a secure electronic reporting system. That's the process that we've been using with our providers over the last years, and that has worked well for us.
Representative Torno, any other questions?
No, that's all. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. There seems to be some background. We're getting another conversation. I don't know if people in the room are speaking, but I guess because of the changed quarters, I would appreciate if you could hold the conversation so we can hear the presenters. Any other questions? I have two. When we talk about latent TB, what would be the test that a provider would use to discover latent TB?
Well,
they could do a TB skin test.
Picture in picture here.
We also have another test that could be used at this point.
There are
two options. Sometimes those TB skin tests are done with new employment, a lot of times in healthcare facilities. It's just that routine TB skin test. And there is a newer test, which is a blood test.
That raises a question. Yeah. If the employer is doing the test, and then you identify it as latent, who does the follow-up? I mean, what happens then? Does the employer or do I get a physician that now, or how's that managed?
What has always happened is that if an employee is screened in a healthcare facility and they're beginning employment there, whatever, and they're screened as positive, they're referred to their healthcare provider for follow-up. They do the follow-up testing. They're the ones that determine in the end whether they have active disease or not. And then they are followed by their healthcare provider. In the past, those latent TB patients might have been referred to our infectious disease staff or community health nurses for some additional case management and follow-up. In the future, we'll be following only those patients that were identified then as high risk that have a higher chance of converting to active.
So then to answer, then it's going to be the provider that's going to have to manage that patient and that responsibility or accountability. If I have latent TB, if I'm in that low, my provider's going to have to monitor me or do the retesting or whatever. That accountability falls on that provider rather than now the state getting involved. Is that correct?
That will be the provider that will be asked to follow up with that patient. For the most part, it will be following up to determine whether they need medication, whether they're taking their medication, and completing their course of treatment.
One last question. When you were developing and doing the revisions, you talked about the interface or the communication with Avera and Sanford. Did you talk to primary care providers out in the rural areas to get their input to realize now they're going to have that responsibility?
We spoke primarily with the folks that we received contact from. We talked specifically to Sanford and Avera and their infectious disease staff. We did not have a specific conversation with other providers. I know that from the Sanford and Avera perspective, they were also speaking for their local clinics and the concerns that they might have.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Valley.
Could you request everyone to put their mute on? We're still getting a lot of feedback here, and I'm trying to determine if it's people working here or if it's someone doesn't have their mute on.
Thank you. Those in the outside areas. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt.
Go ahead.
A question basically with regards to tuberculosis in general. Unfortunately, I can't make a specific reference, but it seems to me that in the last couple of months, there's been some reporting of tuberculosis cases around the United States, that maybe tuberculosis may be back on the rise or the increase. I'm wondering if either of the two presenters would have any CDC statistics on tuberculosis in the United States in general.
We do have some numbers with us that we can share with you. When we look at our national data, it is really not on the rise. It's been decreasing. There were, it appears somewhere in 2009, somewhere around 10,000 cases, but when you look back at 1955, there were 80,000, and it's been a gradual decrease since that time. The same also applies to South Dakota. Although we do have cases, there's been a gradual decline in the numbers of active TB cases.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Are there any other proponents? Oh, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair?
Go ahead.
I'm having problems with the system here, and it might be my mute button because I can't get it on and off, and we have a technician coming. So I'm having difficulty here, but my question was, why was herpes simplex taken off of the list of reportable diseases?
Herpes simplex is not nationally notifiable, though. It's not a nationally notifiable disease. That's why we're taking it off.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Are there other proponents for these rules? Any other proponents? Okay, seeing none, are there opponents to this rule? Opponents? Opponents. Seeing none, I will close this hearing to public testimony and open it up for discussion and or action.
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, move approval.
Senator Valley seconds.
Okay, Representative Hunt moves approval. Senator Valley seconds. Any discussion on that motion?
I don't think anything is necessary further, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary, call the roll.
Gibson?
Representative Gibson.
Better mute to work.
Hunt.
Aye.
Torrio.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Gibson. Hunhoff.
Aye.
Aye. Can you hear me now?
It changes the picture.
Yes, thank you. Motion carried.
Thank you. Motion has carried, and we have approved the rules. Thank you very much, Department, for your presentation.
Thank
Senator
you.
Valley, since you're sitting there, do you want to take Senator Buell's, please?
Sure.
It would be easier if I just walk here.
So sure.
I don't need to look at the street that way.
We'll now have the Department of Labor and Regulation, Division of Insurance, and I believe we have a presenter here in the front of the room, so we'll let you go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. Members of the committee, Randy Moses. We are presenting some emergency rules today as an informational presentation, as I understand it. Just to give a little background on this set of rules, last fall we did a number of rules dealing with the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. And incorporated one of those rules was the setting up of an open enrollment period for children under the age of 19. The federal law, which was passed last year, required effective September 23rd of 2010 that pre-existing conditions not be allowed for children any longer. Then the federal government later imposed some regulations that said that not only can they not do pre-existing condition exclusions, but also cannot underwrite those children. That was different than what was in the statute. Then they put out some guidance saying there could be some open enrollment periods. To make a long story short, South Dakota chose the open enrollment period option, but it ended up differing from the federal guidance in that the federal guidance said there could be no underwriting during non-open enrollment periods, whereas our rules state that we can. So we've been in discussions with the federal agency, HHS, since last fall. They have not determined that we're out of compliance by sending us a formal notice that we're not substantially enforcing it, but nonetheless, they continue to monitor it. With that open enrollment that we've chosen to do that way, we did require that there were certain notifications to persons so that they could apply for open enrollment, so those children that couldn't get insurance during the rest of the year during this 45-day open enrollment beginning July 1st could actually have coverage. We did a survey not too long ago and to follow up on what the insurance carriers were doing to get the notification out, and unfortunately found that the notifications were inadequate and that we're right up against July 1st and found that simply the word was not getting out to affected or children who may well benefit from the open enrollment. So therefore, we issued the emergency rules, tightening up our notification requirements so that the companies clearly have to send a notice to all existing policyholders about the open enrollment so as to take advantage of that for those affected children. And secondly, that they post the open enrollment opportunities on their website prominently. I would add that the Division of Insurance has also did some notifications. We did require the companies to provide us with a list of all rejected children that applied following September 23rd of last year, and then we followed up and sent all those folks a follow-up letter letting them know about the open enrollment period. So hopefully these additional actions will better get the word out so those that want to take advantage of the open enrollment and be able to get health insurance without medical underwriting can do so during this 45-day time period. Thank you. I'll stand by for questions.
Are there questions for Mr. Moses from the committee? Any questions?
I have a question, Mr. Falls. This is Representative Torno. Mr. Moses, so we're really saying under this rule that these carriers must make changes on their website by Friday?
We gave them a requirement that they have the website up. They should have done it already. We had hoped that they would, but some of them had not. We are now confident that pretty much all the carriers now have the website notifications up and are in full compliance.
And then a follow-up, in the rule on page 3, you say that it shall be posted in a location that is readily accessible to the general public, and that that posting will be considered readily accessible if it is on a page where those seeking coverage would normally utilize for this state. Well, I think that's just so awfully broad. I mean, is that really the best language we could come up with? Readily accessible to the general public?
Representative, you certainly have a good point, and quite frankly, we struggled with this concept and had quite a considerable discussion with our legal staff on how to word this to provide the needed flexibility, because not all companies have their web pages set up the same way, but yet make sure that that it was prominent in some way. So that was the best stab we could get at it in this process. We are going to follow up with the formal rules process, have a public hearing, and certainly if the carriers have some better ideas on how to word that, we'll certainly take that into consideration and may well fine-tune the language. But to shortcut the answer is that's the best we could do given the time limitations.
Other questions by the committee? Are there any other proponents for this emergency rule that's already gone into effect? Correct?
Yeah, there's no action.
Yes. Are there any opponents? of this emergency rule that has already gone into effect? If there are none, this does not require a vote, if I'm correct, and we thank you, Mr. Moses, for updating us.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I turn the gavel back to you. Thus it goes to Representative Gibson.
Correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our next department is the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, our Board of Water and Natural Resources, and we're going to amend rules to redistrict the director areas of 7 water development districts and repeal rules due to the end of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. So will our presenter please come forward, identify yourself, and begin your testimony.
Representative Gibson and members of the committee, my name is Pete Jarrus. I'm an environmental scientist manager with the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. I'm going to go ahead and start with the Water Development District rules. I don't know if you want me then to just go into the rules that we're intending to repeal or if we want to just deal with the Water Development District rules first. So to begin with, the effect of the proposed rules or the proposed amendments to the Water Development District Rules 7405.05.16 to 7405.05.21.01 will be to redistrict the director areas of the 7 water development districts. The reason for amending the rules is to reflect the changes of districts due to the 2010 census. The Board of Water and Natural Resources met on June 23rd, and they did adopt the amendments, and the Department of Environment and Natural Resources is recommending approval of the amended rules. I will go ahead and take questions of the committee at this time.
Are there committee questions of this presenter?
Madam Chair?
Senator Hunhoff.
Thank you. In looking at the testimony, help me to understand there was some discussion about waiting till after the redistricting has been done. What's the relationship between redistricting and the districts you're proposing?
Representative Gibson.
Go ahead.
You're correct. You're correct. There is a relationship to the redistricting. It was felt within the department and also the majority of the water development districts that we move ahead at this time with the bulk of the changes. We realize, as do the water development districts, that there will be or there possibly could be some cleanup changes based on the legislative redistricting. And so we were fully aware of that, and we fully intend, if there needs to be some tweaking to go forward at that time.
Follow up?
Go ahead, Senator Hunhoff.
Help me understand the urgency to get this done right now. What's the impact on that to have it done right now?
Well, there is a statute, South Dakota Law 46A-3B3, that states that we're supposed to move ahead, as and the wording is, as soon as possible following each census. And so it was a direction of our staff and our legal counsel that we go ahead and move forward at this time.
One last
question.
Further
follow-up?
One last question. What's the likelihood that this is going to be impacted by the legislative districts?
Go ahead.
Representative Gibson, members of the committee, it could be, yes. There's definitely no question that it could be affected by the legislative redistricting. Again, we felt that it was prudent to move forward with the major changes. At this point in time, there may be some minor changes that could be required after the legislative redistricting.
Thank you.
Follow up. Are there any other questions of committee members?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt.
Representative Hunt, go ahead.
If I could just go back to the presenter, you used the word prudent, but the only thing I've heard in support of that is the statutory language as soon as possible. Do you have any other support for your justification of what's prudent at this point in time? I think we're just a little bit concerned over the fact that this is coming before the redistricting and wanting to make sure that there's a good and justifiable reason for doing it now as opposed to after October 24th.
Representative Gibson,
Go ahead,
members
sir.
Of the committee, the other discussion that we had internally, depending on when the redistricting is done, if it's September, October, it does limit us in our ability to move the process forward in a timely manner. The Board of Water and Natural Resources meeting potentially would be after the first of the year. And so we felt that at this time, it would be best to get the bulk of the changes done. And then, if needed, we would be able to make some of those minor changes at that time.
Follow-up, Representative Heim.
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any other questions from committee members of this presenter? Hearing none, I have one. Mr. Jarvis, how has it traditionally been done in the past for the water development districts as far as redistricting? What is our past tradition for redistricting?
Representative Gibson, members of the committee, when there's been changes to the districts for whatever reason, the census is the main thing. We went through this previously for changes to the districts made in the legislature in 2008 and 2009. And again, when those situations arise, we are tasked, the department is tasked with going through and making those redistrict changes.
Thank you. Are there any other questions by members of the committee of this presenter? Are there other proponents?
Madam Chair.
Senator Hunhoff.
You know, I don't think your question was answered, and I'm curious. What did you do in 2000? What was the timing of the redistricting and when the legislative districts were set?
Representative Gibson.
Go ahead.
Members of the committee, I personally cannot answer that question. I was not with the department at that time. I'm assuming they move forward as we are currently. I'll let Mr. Feeney may have a little bit of history on that subject.
James Feeney, I'm an administrator at DNR, and I was around when that was done last, and it was a similar time frame. Again, we're probably more aware of some of the issues of the redistricting because it may make some subtle changes in voting precincts in higher population areas. Probably was not even on our radar, and these concerns were not brought up when we moved ahead. And I believe we were ahead of redistricting after the 2000 census, but I don't have any specific dates on when the rules were adopted. But as Pete did note, with the legislative changes in 2008 and 2009, we moved ahead again as soon as those were in effect. And there are some other changes. Central Plains, because the change in population has gone from a 7-district board to a 5-district board, so we were also encouraged at the close of the last of the calendar year by Secretary of State Nelson to move ahead and make those changes in case there are vacancies that in this interim time period, these tend to be tough positions to fill in some areas, and if there are vacancies, having the new district director areas is beneficial to getting people to commit to serving on these boards.
Follow up, Senator Hunhoff.
Yes, when will the elections be held based on what gets done today?
I would probably defer to the, I know there's representatives from the Water Development Districts at the site in Huron, but I believe it's a time frame that petitions have to be developed in March, and it's at the June election that would be the initial vote for vacancies or for district director areas whose term is up.
One last question. If the redistricting would have an impact, do you have to introduce statute, or is it by rule change, which would not occur till after the session?
Go ahead.
I believe everything we are doing is on a rules change, if I understand the question.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions of the committee? I have with me at my site in Huron, Jay Gilbertson from the East River, East Dakota Water District, and he'd like to make some comments.
Thank you, Representative Gibson, members of the committee. Again, Jay Gilbertson with East Dakota Water Development District, and I'm here to support the department's request at this time. As has been noted, at the end of the legislative redistricting process, there will be some minor adjustments, particularly in the communities of Sioux Falls and Rapid City, our large population bases. But the lion's share of the adjustments and changes that are being presented here today in the rural areas and less populated parts of the districts really aren't going to make a big change. And the changes are going to be moving as voting precinct boundaries get moved a block or two to the east or west. There's no way for Minnehaha County to know exactly what the precincts are going to look like until the legislature gets done. But in the meantime, we have a pretty good idea about where the boundaries are going to fall. We know where the shifts are going to take place, and has been noted where there have been major population adjustments. We can start to adapt for that. My recollection, as with Jim's, was that 10 years ago, we went through the process well in advance of the legislative decisions at the end of the 2001. The codified law is pretty clear. Do it as soon as you can. Perhaps this is going to be a good argument come the next session to make a change in that, but in the meantime, the department is following the letter of the law, and from East Dakota's perspective, and I think James River as well, we just as soon have them do that. Thank you.
Are there questions for the questions of Mr. Gilbertson? Hearing none, are there other proponents for this set of rules? Seeing or hearing none, are there opponents? Are there opponents for this set of rules? Hearing none, I will close the hearing to public testimony and move to committee discussion and or action.
Move to approve.
And is that Representative Torno?
Torno, right.
Okay, is there a second, please?
Valley, second.
Seconded by Senator Valley. All in favor will say aye, opposed no, and the secretary will please call the roll.
Hunt?
Aye.
Torno?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Hunha?
Aye.
Gibson?
Aye. Motion carried, and this set of rules is approved. I will now pass the gavel to Representative Hunt in Sioux Falls.
Representative Gibson, this is Doug in Peter. Mr. Jarris needs to go through the repeal set of the rules, too. That was the only thing that was presented so far was the redistricting. Now the second package deals with repeals.
I'm sorry, Mr. Jarris. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Thank you, please. Representative Gibson, members of the committee, the effect of the rules repeal will be to repeal the entire chapter 7405.13.1 to 7405.13.23, which has to deal with the distribution of money for the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The reason for repealing the rules is that this, as I mentioned, this chapter dealt with awarding of the funds. All funds have been awarded, making the rules irrelevant and thus unnecessary. The rules went through the regular process. We received no comments. The Board of Water and Natural Resources did approve the repeal of this chapter at their June 23rd meeting. DNR is recommending approval of the repeal. Again, basically, this is just a cleanup of rules that no longer apply.
Thank you, Mr. Jarvis. Are there other proponents to this set of rules, or are there questions by committee members of this particular rule? Are there other proponents? Are there opponents to this set of rules? Hearing none, seeing none, I will close this hearing to public testimony and move to committee discussion and or action.
Madam Chair, I move to accept these rules. Senator Valley.
Senator Valley moves to approve the rules. Is there a second?
Second, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Representative Hunt. The motion has been made and seconded to pass these rules. The Secretary will call the roll, vote aye to approve and nay to disapprove. Hunt.
Aye.
Toino.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Gibson.
Aye. The rules have been passed, and now I'll pass the gavel to Representative Hunt in Sioux Falls. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This Representative Hunt in Sioux Falls will move on to the next set of rules being presented by the Bureau of Personnel, the Career Service Commission. And would the first presenter please come forward and make your presentation.
Representative Hunt, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Kevin Forsch with the Bureau of Personnel. I also have our attorney with us for the Bureau of Personnel, Jeff Bloomberg, and he will be up here to my right in a minute. The rules today are Article 5501, Career Service System. We noticed in three papers, Yankton, Pier, and Rapid City. We had a hearing May 25th. Had a few people attend. That hearing was before the Career Service Commission. Not sure if you all are familiar with that commission, a five-member board that is dedicated to the Bureau of Personnel, so to speak, hears rules as well as other disciplinary issues and so forth. What I'd like to do is just quickly highlight the main points in the rules changes, Representative Hunt. I won't go over all the form and style changes if that's okay with you, but certainly I can answer any questions if you have those.
That's fine, go ahead.
Thank you. Moving into the definitions, we have definition number 17, which is immediate family. That definition of immediate family is used when a state employee uses personal leave. We're adding stepbrothers and stepsisters to that. Moving also to definition 38, temporary employee. It's an employee appointed to short-term employment. We needed to clarify, based on an issue we had with an individual that had applied for a temporary position, thinking they had career status, when in fact temporary employees do not have career status. So we had to make sure that they understood that a temporary employee, we wanted to clarify that a temporary employee is not entitled to the benefits or rights or of a status employee. Moving to 550107, disability consideration. When an individual applies for a position as an applicant, we have certain certified applicants that are afforded certain rights, certain privileges, if you will. One of those is an individual that would have a severe disability. We had at Volk Rehab had asked us to include in our definition or in our process here their ability to certify those individuals every 5 years instead of an indefinite certification. To clarify, this rule deals only with an individual applying for a position as an applicant, not somebody that's already a state employee or has secured a position. So you would only need to make sure that your certification was current while you were applying for a state position. 550108 deals with a probationary employee. That's simply an update on term and definition. Register is outdated, no longer used by our classification system. They use the term certification. So that's just an update. Page 7, 550113 deals with appeals. Really three sections here. One is the appeal of a layoff. 550115-0101 is the layoff procedure. And then 0102 is the layoff plan criteria. We're proposing under the appeal of a layoff to delete that rule. We feel as we reviewed these statutes, and by the way, we did review as just part of our internal process all of 5501, and that's why you see multiple changes throughout this set of rules. We felt this rule was outdated and was also a conflict of interest or conflict of powers. Basically, if we had laid off or provided a layoff for employees either through an executive order, an administrative order, or a legislative intent or legislative action at the end of session, that an employee would have the opportunity to appeal that layoff, a career status employee, to appeal that layoff before the Career Service Commission. And the Career Service Commission could then potentially either be in conflict or overrule a legislative action, if you will, based on the elimination or removal of a position or the removal of a program or a department. The two other issues dealing with layoff are procedure and plan criteria. The layoff procedure was in place many years ago when the HR, when the human resource functions were within each department, each state agency had those. We combined that in the 90s so that the HR function is a centralized function within the Bureau of Personnel. That procedure or process is no longer necessary, and what we tried to do was combine, or what we did was combine the layoff procedure, the important parts of that, in with the layoff plan criteria to combine those two into one rule. So basically you see under a layoff plan criteria, if an agency wants to go through a layoff process, they need to identify the individuals, individual or individuals. They need to justify the reason for the layoff, and those justification criteria are listed. And then if there's more than one incumbent, then there's also a set of criteria in this rule which explains the criteria that the agency needs to use in terms of choosing which individual's laid off if there's more than one incumbent in that position that they're laying off. All of those justifications and rationale and reasoning need to be submitted in a plan, which is then submitted before the Bureau of Personnel and approved by the Commissioner of the Bureau of Personnel before that department then proceeds with the layoff procedure. Moving on to 012201, vacation leave. We simply updated to the new payroll system, which the old system was a biweekly. Now we have a semi-monthly pay period, so it was simply an update. Under the 5501-2202 personal leave, the opportunity for a state employee to leave their position or leave their post, if you will, to perform voluntary police work, rescue work, and that also now includes fire, ambulance, is already covered under our Bureau of Personnel administrative leave rules. So this was just really redundant, so we struck it out of here, and that currently is under administrative leave. The last rule, Representative Hunt, members of the committee, is the emergency furlough. Several months ago, when the federal government was on the verge of issuing furloughs, if you will, there was quite a bit of discussion in state amongst really all states and in South Dakota as well about furloughs. And I think there was a fair amount of confusion amongst state employees. Even within our own department, our own bureau, we had some confusion on that issue and other departments. We proposed to add a line to clarify that an emergency furlough does not require prior notice to employees. It never did, and it's not anywhere in this rule that requires us to give prior notice to employees on an emergency furlough, but we felt because of the confusion we needed to clarify that, so we added that sentence to that. Representative Hunt, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's all I have, and certainly would be here to answer questions.
Thank you. I'm going to exercise a chairman's prerogative. We have an opposition witness here in Sioux Falls that has to leave momentarily to catch a flight. So I'm going to allow him at this point in time to introduce himself. Then we'll come back and take questions of the proponents, take any other proponents, and move back into the regular system. But at this point in time, I'm going to give Mr. Mark Anderson an opportunity to present his comments in opposition to these rules. Mr. Anderson, if you would please identify yourself.
Thank you, Representative Hunt. My name is Mark Anderson. I'm President and Financial Secretary of the South Dakota State Federation of Labor. And the reason I'm here, first I would like to, I did submit some written testimony, and I see that there's a typo in that in the last line. I see that rule 5501, 15-01-01 is in there twice. One of those should be 5501, 13-04-1. So really, I'm opposed to the changes dealing with the layoff and the furlough. There seems to be a, on a national level, there seems to be an outright attack on public employees everywhere, and I would just assume that that didn't carry on to South Dakota. Quite frankly, the public employees are an important part of the economy in South Dakota, and they haven't had a raise for 3 years. And now, besides that, we're going to pile on and take away their right to appeal a layoff. And these rules have been on the books, like I said, since 1975. I don't know that we need to make changes in these rules and take those very simple, important rights away from public employees. They're an important part of the state economy, and I think we need to really take a close look when we're making changes in rules just to make changes when they've been around this long. And I haven't heard anybody testify or haven't seen any written testimony to the fact that they've been a problem. If there was an issue with these rules and appeals that have been made and those kinds of things, but when we're in a position like we are now, and there's probably a chance of layoff if the economy continues to spiral downward and doesn't pick up, I think these state employees really deserve the right to appeal their layoff. Whether it's something that the governor's office does or whether it's a legislative issue, I think they should have the right to appeal that layoff, and really so that someone has to explain to them why they're being laid off and the importance of that layoff to them and our state if it should come to that. So I would ask you to oppose the change in these rules. Basically, on an economic issue, if we get into a position of layoff, because when there's a layoff, it takes money out of whatever community those layoffs are in directly. So I think that's something that needs to be considered, and I think if we can take it to the commission and they can take a second look at this when this stuff is going on, I think it's important that these rules stay in. So I would ask the members of the committee to oppose them for that reason. Thank you.
I'm going to offer any members of the committee an opportunity to ask questions of Mr. Anderson at this point in time. Questions of Mr. Anderson by members of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question, please.
Go ahead, Representative.
Mr. Anderson, do you feel that this is an interference, a direct interference here with our current system of checks and balances for our state employees, and it interferes with the protection of their individual rights to appeal a layoff. Is that what you're saying?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's an important right that the employees still maintain. As Mike said, it's been on the books since 1975. I don't think we need to jump to conclusions and start taking these things out of their rights. I mean, they ought to have that right to understand why they're being laid off and appeal it if they don't think it's accurate or correct.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Any other questions?
I have a question.
Representative Turner.
Mr. Anderson, you made the analogy of public sector employees and as to private sector employees. You're not claiming that private sector employees have any right to appeal a layoff if they were laid off, do you?
Representative Hunt, you must have muted your...
I'm sorry, I did. Mr. Anderson, would you repeat your answer?
The Career Services Commission does not apply to public employees. Private employees. It only applies to public employees, and I believe that they should have this right to appeal their layoff.
Representative Gibson, anything further? Any other members of the committee wish to ask Mr. Anderson any questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you for letting me be out of line.
No problem. We'll now move back to proponents of these rules. Mr. Secretary, I see you're standing up the witness stand. Do you intend to make any comments at this time?
Former Secretary, Representative Hunt.
I'm sorry.
I don't think I have to add anything to comments that Mr. Forsch made.
Then in that case, we'll go to any further questions that the members of the committee might have of Mr. Forsch.
Mr. Chairman, I ask a question, please, of this presenter.
Go ahead.
Sir, say I'm a state employee and I'm going to be laid off under the old system. Please walk me through what my rights are as an employee under the current rules and how this is actually going to change with these rules, please.
Good question, Representative Gibson. Thank you. Under the current system, the first thing that has to happen is an agency has to develop a plan. And then under the current rules, there's a plan procedure or a layoff procedure and a plan criteria. And so those have to be submitted to the Bureau of Personnel, to the Commissioner for approval. Under what we're proposing, that will not change. So if a department has a layoff of an individual or individuals, they need to submit a plan with justification and criteria to the Bureau of Personnel. Once that plan's approved, then notice is given by the department to that employee or employees 14 days at a minimum prior to the layoff. Then currently, that employee then would have the right to appeal, once they've been given notice, that layoff to the commission.
Any follow-up?
Thank you, Representative Hunt. And so now, under the rule change, what happens to me as an employee?
Yep, the plan and the criteria and the justification are all still intact. The Bureau of Personnel is the safety check or the safeguard, if you will, to make sure that plan is submitted correctly, and the department submits that plan to the Bureau, to the Commissioner for her approval prior to that department issuing a layoff notice to the employee. Then once that employee is noticed under the proposed set here, proposed set of rules, then the employee is given 14-day notice. They then do not have the right to appeal to the commission. They are afforded certain reemployment rights, and up to a year have the opportunity to apply for state positions. They have the opportunity to be given preferential treatment on any positions that are open as an applicant when given a layoff notice.
Representative
Follow
Gibson.
Up, Representative Hunt.
Go ahead.
Representative Gibson, if I could add, there's one other step that would be included in the current process, and that is if the commission voted to uphold the layoff, or if they voted the other direction and said we're going to deny the layoff, then either party could appeal that decision to the circuit court, and ultimately that decision could be end up in front of the South Dakota Supreme Court, and they would make the ultimate decision. So as an example, the legislature could eliminate a program, eliminate the FTE, eliminate the funding for a program. Under the current rules, the employee could appeal that to the Career Service Commission, who could vote to say, no, we're not going to support the layoff, at which point in time then the agency could appeal that to the South Dakota Supreme Court, and you would have the Supreme Court deciding whether the layoff with the elimination of the FTE and the funding was appropriate. That would not be true under the current rules. Once the commissioner had reviewed the process and determined that the layoff was appropriate and necessary, then there would be no appeal to the commission or to circuit court.
Follow-up, Representative Hunt. Representative Hunt. So in other words, then, you're taking a step away from me from the judicial system. I cannot go to the court system and appeal this layoff. So I could be arbitrarily laid off at a job I've worked at for 20 years for no specific reason, and I can't use the court system to my advantage. Is that what you're telling me here?
Representative Gibson, not true in your choice of words. It wouldn't be arbitrary, and it would be for no reason at all. As I said earlier, any layoff requires prior approval by the commissioner. So if I'm the Department of Transportation and I'm going to lay off one employee or 10, I need to develop a plan. I need to follow the criteria listed in the proposed rules in terms of justification, in terms of rationale and reasoning, submit that to the Bureau of Personnel for the commissioner's approval. If the procedure is not followed, criteria are not followed, or if there's more than one incumbent and the Department of, say, Transportation doesn't list reason and rationale for why this employee A was chosen over 10 other employees, then that plan will not be approved and the layoff will not go forward until the department justifies the reasons. Once it's approved by the commissioner, then the employee is noticed, given 14 days prior. And I have to just add, Representative, this is an important, in the last 3 months following session, there were somewhere between, 20, 30, 40 layoff notices given. I think as a good employer, and I'll stand behind that 100%, I think the state is viewed as a responsible, good employer. Notices were given to employees for layoffs anywhere from 6 months out up to at least 30 days to try to help every single employee through attrition find another job within state government. So I don't see this, although some may say that this is an attempt to take away employee rights and to erode the system? I don't see that.
Follow up, Representative Hunt.
Go ahead.
How many employees are affected by this, and just exactly whose idea was it to change these rules? I see that there is no fiscal impact whatsoever on state government or keeping them as they are. So whose idea was it to change this, and really why are you changing it? Because it doesn't seem to be an arduous task to begin with. And, you know, and once again, I don't feel that I could go to the courts. I have to go to the commission. The commission is totally appointed by the government, or governor, isn't that true? So if I came in as one political party, and the governor happens to be not of my political party, am I going to be discriminated against to be as a state employee because I've been politically active, or I am an employee that the governor just wants to get rid of through his commission?
Mr. Forrest, go ahead and answer if you wish.
Thank you. Representative Gibson, great question. Lots of questions within that single question, though. Let me see if I can address those. First, there are roughly 13,000 active state employees. This affects the Career Service Commission or Career Service Status employees. That's about half. So for round numbers, let's just say 6,000 to 6,500 state employees. And I should make a note, when we proposed these rules, had a hearing May 25th, prior to that, for about 2 weeks, this set of rules almost had a separate and second hearing publicly. I was on public radio. Both of the major papers in the state presented on this issue. So I think not only did this get a fair hearing before the Career Service Commission, but this set of rules, I would argue, might have had one of the more public hearings or public notices of any rules we've done. Of those 6,500 state employees, we had notice from 10 individuals for a set of rules. Of those, about half were automatic notifiers. So basically, prior to the rules hearing, and since that time, we've had requests for a set of rules from about 5 state employees out of 6,500 that are affected by this. Why did we do these? We did these at the directive of the administration in terms of looking at all our rules, looking at our laws and our policies, same directive given to all state agencies, not unfamiliar with any new administration that comes in and asks each department to take a look at their statutes, to take a look at their rules, and to take a look at their internal policies. We've gone through our policy review. In fact, we're in the process of finalizing those policies. We've started a review committee on our statutes this week, led by our counsel, Mr. Bloomberg, and we completed the review of our rules in April and then proposed the hearing before the commission in May. So the reason why, Representative Gibson, was simply just a review of rules that hadn't been done in quite a while. On behalf of the Bureau personnel. So there was nothing targeted towards state employees or the timing of layoffs, anything to that effect.
Any follow-up, Representative?
No, thank you.
Are there any other questions by members of the committee? Representative Turner.
Question for Mr. Bloomberg, well, either one, I guess. A couple things, just as I read this, it doesn't say where the appointing authority shall submit a plan. I understand if you read all the way through, you get down to the bottom and it says the commission must approve it, but I'm wondering why we don't say where it shall be submitted. The appointing authority shall submit a plan where? And part of my thought process, you think it might help some of the opponents or those that have concerns about this, if you were to say that that appointing authority shall submit a plan both to the commissioner and almost as a courtesy, for no other reason than a courtesy, to the Career Service Commission. Just a thought to think about. And then secondarily, is it true and would it be true if the language says the criteria, of course, criteria are always going to be of concern to the employees. If you said in that criteria area, those who will be laid off include, and then you list out the different criteria to look at, but just add something or have some language that says include, but not necessarily in that order. And my question is, I guess two-part on that as well. Is it in that order, or if it's not in that order, is it a combination of factors? With that, I'll leave it to you to go ahead and answer.
I'll answer the second part, Representative Tourneau, and the listing of criteria based on performance, longevity, employee status, special skills, knowledge, it can be any one or a combination thereof of those criteria, and no, it's not listed based on preference or order that they use performance first and longevity. In response to your second question, I think, or your second comment, if you will, submit a plan to the commissioner or the Bureau of Personnel, I think that's an excellent suggestion, and we will absolutely look at that. Thank you.
Any other questions by members of the committee?
Mr. Chair, Mike Valley.
Go ahead, Senator.
Just a question on the, you say there has to be a plan that needs to be followed that's sent to the Bureau of Personnel, correct?
Right.
Let's say that it's felt that they didn't follow that plan. Could I then have a case to take to court? Can you say, you know, the Bureau of Personnel, here was a plan laid out, and golly bomb, they didn't even come close to following that plan. Do I have something? Do I have some redress? Can I take that part to court because they didn't follow that rule or that plan? I mean, because the plan is put down to be followed, and if it's not followed, what's the redress there? That would be my concern.
Go ahead. Well, let me answer the first part in terms of what I deal with, and I'll turn the legal side of that over to Mr. Bloomberg. When the plan's approved on behalf of the commission and then sent back to the department for notice to the employees, then our human resource managers, which are within the Bureau of Personnel, and there's one assigned to every agency or agencies, in fact, most of them carry two or three agencies, they are involved then in directly drafting the letters and giving notice to the employees and sitting down in those meetings. So we're fairly comfortable, Senator, internally, that once the plan's approved, that it's absolutely carried out to the letter with our individuals involved. But in the remote chance that it wouldn't be.
There is a, and I don't have it in front of me, but there is a catch-all rule in our career service rules that essentially say if the policies, procedures aren't followed, that that is appealable. And that, I don't know if Kevin can find that quickly, but. So I think there would be a route for an individual who was laid off and the department did not follow their plan, submit it to the commissioner to use that catch-all rule as a way to get into an appeal. And that would go then to the Career Service Commission for the first hearing.
Mr. Chair, and this is kind of going back to Representative Gibson's question. I just want to peel the onion back a little bit. If, as she said, if there is some reason that feels that there's wrongly being treated through retribution, whether it's, you know, them, something political or whatever, that obviously would not be part of the plan, and that person would have then, I'm just saying, would they have some right of redress if that was done for reasons that were not in the plan, and they could show that. So is that what I'm asking?
Yes.
Can that be taken care of, and can I take that part to court?
Yes.
So, Senator Valley, thank you for your question, and I apologize to Representative Gibson because I did not fully answer her question, because that was an important part of what prevents a state agency from just arbitrarily, a supervisor and an employee don't get along, and a supervisor decides we don't need that position, we're going to lay that individual off regardless of the criteria. If there's any kind of a discrimination or other issue, wage and hour issue, there are certain federal protections that are afforded an employee regardless of what we do with this set of rules, either through the EEOC, Federal Department of Labor, and we, knock on wood, we don't see those very often in South Dakota. Again, I know we're a great employer, a responsible employer, but from time to time we do get an EEOC or a federal labor issue. Also, especially if more than one incumbent's involved, then that's the important part.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if there's a class of employees, let's say it can be conservation officers or public health specialists, where there's more than one individual, and they all happen to be within a certain section, within a certain division, if you will, and let's just say there's five individuals that all have that same class title, and based either on a legislative action or an administrative action, they choose to lay off one individual out of those five, then they have to follow the criteria based on performance, longevity, special skills, knowledge, etc., and can't just take the one that they don't like, so to speak.
And if I feel that that's been done,
okay,
then I can take that grievance to an attorney and have redress. Would that be correct?
If I could quote the rule, I've found it here in the rules. It's 5501-130403, other appeals. An employee may appeal the misinterpretation, misapplication, or violation of any existing agreement, contract, policy, or rule, excluding overtime pay issues as they apply to the conditions of employment. So if the new rules adopted and the agency submitted their plan pursuant to the rule, and the commissioner approved the plan, and then the agency, for whatever reason, didn't follow their plan, I believe that that particular rule would allow them to appeal the misapplication of that rule to them, ultimately to the Career Service Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me the latitude in questioning.
Any other questions by members of the committee or these presenters? Representative Turner, and then Representative Gibson. Representative Turner.
Representative Hunt, I think you've muted yourself again.
Sorry.
Question for Mr. Bloomberg. And I appreciate that he just read 1304.03. I don't have that language. I'm just going with what I just heard. However, I guess I have a concern. If that's the catch-all that was going to be used, given that you're repealing the actual appeal of layoff provision, what would the procedure be for that type of other appeal? If you look at the language you're getting rid of, it says that appeal should be made pursuant to the grievance procedure. How would a person know under that other appeal section what the procedure would be?
Go ahead.
Well, it would depend upon the agency. Every agency has the ability to adopt, and most of them have adopt their own procedure for grievances. And so they would start out with the department grievance procedure, which would, in most cases, starts at the division level, works its way up through the secretary, and then from there would go to the commissioner, and then ultimately to the Career Service Commission. So I think that that's what they would do, is follow their department policy. If they didn't have a department policy, they could appeal it, I believe, right to the Career Service Commission.
Be clear, the other appeal section doesn't say follow the departmental grievance procedure, does it?
It says, yeah, it does. It says, excuse me for not reading all of it. The appeal shall be made pursuant to the departmental grievance procedure or the procedure found in 5501.13.22 if the department does not have an approved procedure. So that's how it gets bootstrapped into the rest of the appeal process.
Representative Gibson.
Just exactly, I don't see these rules as an update at all. I see these rules as an attack on state employees that doesn't need to be made. So why do you feel that we need to change these rules? Just to change.
If I represented...
Go ahead, please.
As Kevin indicated, we were in the middle of reviewing these rules at about the same time the federal government decided that they were going to, on a Friday afternoon, I think we were that close to shutting down federal funding for a number of programs in South Dakota. And I think that's the first time this rule actually caught our eye in the Bureau of Administration is, okay, what do we do with these programs where there is no money to pay the folks? And so that's really brought it to our attention. What happens if the feds cut off funding for a program, or the legislature says it needs to end, takes away the funding, takes away the FTE, or the governor determines that there isn't any work for these individuals anymore, or that it's inefficient under the current arrangement, that there needs to be an ability to deal with that and to have a process where an employee could essentially override the legislature or override a decision of the governor. It just didn't seem to make sense, and that's really what was the impetus for this rule change.
I would like to keep moving, but Representative Gibson for a further follow-up.
Thank you, Senator or Representative Hunt. That's enough for me now. Thank you.
Thank you. At this point, do we have any other proponents on these Career Service Commission rules? Any other proponents? Seeing none, are there any opponents? Are there any opponents other than the testimony given by Mr. Anderson here earlier?
Representative Hunt,
Yes.
The South Dakota State Employees Organization.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Again, I'll say it's Corey Landine with the South Dakota State Employees Organization. Thank you for allowing me here today to testify in opposition to two of the proposed changes. The first one is the repeals and repealing the rule allowing an appeal of a layoff. I appreciate the questions by the committee. You stole some of my thunder, but I'll proceed anyway. Our primary concern is that the proposed change eliminates the rule allowing an employee to appeal a layoff. The proposed change removes the responsibility of the employer from having to prove that a layoff was necessary. The current rule is a staple of our career service system. The elimination of this rule damages the entire system. The elimination of this rule removes the Career Service Commission as a layer of protection from arbitrary dismissal. And I believe that there is room for arbitrary dismissal if these proposals are accepted. The proposed rule change keeps the language in the rule that says the appointing authority must notify the employee at least 14 days before the effective date of a layoff and must give written notice of the justification of the layoff or reduction. Senator Valley raised the question, what's the point of having notice, criteria, and justification if the employee has no recourse and appeal it? Now, the provision that they just laid out in this other appeal, I don't understand the purpose of changing the appeal process at all. If the employee is still going to have the right to appeal these types of decisions, there's no point in even changing the rule. And I haven't had the opportunity to really study that to make sure that it went, that the, all circumstances where the employee would have the opportunity to appeal. So I can't really speak on that specific one. So we would ask that the committee not eliminate this long-standing provision. And Mr. Anderson stated that the rules have been in place since the mid-70s. I believe that's correct. 1973 was the date I had. It's a long-standing provision to our career service system, and it allows our career service employees the protections that they deserve as public employees. And I'll just say that the difference between the public and the private sector having the opportunity to have this appeal process is that the public sector, the reason these provisions were put into place was to ensure we had good government. It was to eliminate the patronage system that was in place in the federal level, and the states came around and followed. So we didn't have a bunch of political appointees, regardless of the party that was in power, being pushed out and new people brought in every time we had a new administration. It was to ensure that the citizens of our state had sound government and people who were offered the opportunity for employment with the state of South Dakota based on merit versus based on who you know. The second rule change that we have concern about is the opportunity not to give prior notice for employee of a furlough. I can envision a situation where an employee is placed on a furlough with no notice, and during the period of time that employee is on furlough, they're notified that they're being laid off. Well, now the employee is on a furlough that they had no notice of, and they're being notified that they are being laid off, and they have no recourse. There's no appeal. So basically, you could furlough an employee, and then they could leave their job and not have the opportunity to come back into employment with the state of South Dakota if they were laid off during their furlough. And that could happen. And I'm not going to say that there's any intent by this administration, but if we eliminate these rules, it's just an open door down the road where these types of things could happen. Now, you can go back and say, we gave plenty of notice to people in the past, and that's fine, and I'm glad that we did that. But that's eliminating these rules means that you wouldn't have had to do that. And so that's why we think it's important that the rule that allows for an appeal of a layoff stays in place, and that's why we would like to see notice given on a furlough. The reason I think that language is being included on the furlough is because if you go and you look at the changes to the layoff plan criteria, 5501, 1501, 02, and the last paragraph, the word any is underlined, is inserted in there. And I think that's why they have to say that would include a furlough. And so that is why they're going and not giving the opportunity of notice. Because without the word any in that current rule, there is nowhere that says you don't have the opportunity for notice or that notice is not required. And I'll just close by saying, and I'll just back to Senator Valley's question again, because it's one I was going to bring up. If you have two people in the same certain situation, or five people, and a layoff plan is used, and it's any combination of those, that's pretty arbitrary in itself right there, pretty vague, that you can use any combination of those five or six criteria that are laid out, and then you tell employee B that they're not being retained, and you're retaining employee A. Employee B doesn't have any recourse. If you follow the plan, the vague plan that there is, and use any combination, I can imagine, think of the number of ways you could use any combination of those to justify keeping the person you wanted to keep versus not keeping the person you wanted to keep. So that person has no recourse whatsoever if the plan is followed. And I think that's something that it's a step backwards for the state of South Dakota. It took us 70 years after the federal government put in a merit system, our career service protections, to get that in our books. And I don't see why there's any reason why we need to eliminate that provision. I'll echo what Representative Gibson said. There's no fiscal ramification. The fact that the conflict with the decision of the legislature or the executive branch and bring the courts into play, well, I think that's just part of our that is democracy. That is part of our system. It's checks and balances, is to have each branch of government checking and balancing each other out in decisions they make. This decision right now is the executive branch trying to eliminate a rule that prohibits its authority. The reason that that rule's in there is, as I stated before, because we don't want to go back to a patronage system. We want to hire people in the state government. Right now, Mr. Forsh stated that we have between 6,000 and 6,500 state employees in the career service system. That's like half. The federal government is about 85 to 90%, the last time I checked. And you know, to say that 50% of the people that work for state government are not in the career service already indicates that we have a number of people that are in a position where they didn't have to go through the same probationary period as career service employees did. Those people have to go through a six-month probationary period to prove that they're worthy to have that job. And if they pass that probationary period, then you know they're offered full-time employment. It's a good provision. It's good for the citizens of South Dakota, and I would urge that the committee not accept these proposed changes and keep the system the way it is and keep intact the protections for our employees. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe, Mr. Dean, thank you. Questions of this witness by members of the committee? Any questions? Seeing, hearing none, thank you very much. We'll take further opponents. Opponents. Are there any opponents? If not, at this point in time, then we'll close the committee hearing to the taking of public testimony and move to committee discussion and or action on these Career Service Commission rules. Representative Gibson, I believe. Go ahead.
No, this is Senator Hunoff.
Sorry, Senator. Go ahead.
That's okay. I move adoption of the rules as proposed.
We have a motion to approve and adopt. Is there a second?
Senator Valley will second.
Senator Valley second. So we have a motion by Senator Hunoff, second by Senator Valley. Any discussion? Senator Hunoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm sitting here thinking career service, private, public sector, due process, and why should I in the private sector, the dollars aren't coming in because of Medicaid funding, and my boss walks in my office and says, we can't support this program anymore, and so we're going to eliminate your position, and I'm out the door. I think that there's process built in, that there is criteria if there are layoffs. I'm not buying the sense that to point or hire people simply because of party affiliation or who's in the administration. I haven't seen that demonstrated in my 11 years in the legislature and dealing with all the departments. It's the right person. I think what they're trying to do is make the process so that they can provide, so that if funding is cut, and you have to do something, for an employee to say, no, you can't give me the 14-day notice, you have to keep me hired, there's no money coming in. I don't think that's due process for the state in trying to manage the resources that they have. I think what they're putting in place still gives the employee the opportunity. There has to be justification in what the decision is, who falls into that layoff, and they've got the criteria listed there. And I think that's more than what you see in the private sector, because as I said, they can just walk in and say, We're done. We've seen it in this community with manufacturing. People lost their jobs because they didn't have the markets to come in and buy the product. And I think the state is trying to respond, and that's part of the process. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion on the motion to adopt and approve.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Do not, my substitute motion is do not pass.
We have a substitute motion by Representative Gibson to do not pass and approve. Is there a second?
I'm going to second that.
Seconded by Representative Turner. Discussion on that substitute motion, Representative Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I disagree with the good senator from Yankton. I do feel that the executive branch is trying to eliminate oversight of its actions by the judicial branch, and I very much oppose that. I think our state employees deserve to have a hearing on a layoff. I don't think there's absolutely no fiscal impact to leave these rules in place. I think they're judicious as they are and give the employee a little bit of say in his or her disagreement, and I think that the rules as proposed are just wrong. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion on the substitute motion.
If I...
Representative Turner.
Thank you. With what Senator Hunhoff said. However, my trouble and my concern about these rules are through the testimony that we heard from the department is that, well, there is an appeal available under this catch-all provision, other appeals. Let me just cut to the chase. I think the idea behind these rules is appropriate. However, I think they're not correctly written as they sit today. Here's my concern. It's actually on sort of the opposite side of where Representative Gibson is, but yet I join your motion, and here's why. Under the other appeals provision that I heard, there's no time frame set. So an employee could be laid off and 90 days later say, you know, I don't think they followed the plan. And they would have what we heard today from Mr. Bloomberg is that they could appeal then either, well, I guess through the process, ultimately through the Career Service Commission. The only part, the limited part that I agree with Mr. Landine about is, if that's true, why are we changing the rule? And my concern is that opens it up. If you're going to fall into that generic other appeals provision, that opens the time frame up. Katie barred the door. It could be 9 days later, it could be 6 months later, it could be a year later. Because I didn't hear, and I don't have that provision in front of me, but I did not hear a time frame set forth. What I see in the provision that they're getting rid of is a reasonable time period of 14 days. But they've now eliminated that and said, and I understand that the department would be saying, well, but it would be limited to this more narrow, a failure to follow the plan. I also have concerns the way that it's listed that I think it could be used against the department for what I touched on earlier. And I'm looking at specifically 15.01.02, the layoff plan criteria, where it says to include, and it lists out. I think it ought to say, but not necessarily in that order, or maybe it should say more weight given to A, B, and C, and less weight given to D, E, and F, something like that, but a more specific provision. I also think to alleviate this concern, again, I think it is the prerogative of state government to lay off if there is the need, like there would be in the private sector. But I think to alleviate some of this concern, I do think it would be appropriate that this the plan is submitted not only to the Bureau of Personnel, but also submitted as a quasi checks and balance to the Career Service Commission. I get that they wouldn't really have any action, but it is a lay board that if they had concerns when they saw it, just for their general review, that I would trust that that commission, I've been in front of that commission, I would trust that they would relay those concerns to the personnel folks, and it could be addressed. I think it is a fair, like I say, quasi check and balance that could be added, should be added to this rule. So again, for as the Supreme Court sometimes says, I think that something is right for the wrong reason. I think this is almost the opposite. I think this is wrong for other reasons than what we heard from Representative Gibson. So for that reason, I'm going to oppose the adoption of these rules.
Further discussion on the substitute motion?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Valley, is it? Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. Well, we've heard a lot of testimony here, and I go back to, number one, I go back to what our job is. And our job is to, one, see if the agency or the department is writing rules that are outside the purview of the law that's on the books. I haven't heard anyone at this point say that they feel that the Department of Personnel has exceeded their authority and the ability to legally put these rules forward. Second, did they have a hearing and invite all possible people, or were people aware of this rule? And I think they have done a good job of that. I remember, in fact, I still got the story here from the article in the Argus Leader. So I'm assuming it got out to a lot of different places. So it was a proper hearing. Did they take into account the questions that people had? That's always a tough one, but it appears that they have for the goal that they have. Another one is, are they foisting any increased costs onto any other form of government? And obviously that's not the case here. So when I look at those, I feel that whether I agree or disagree with the law, and I have had this happen to me before, where I have voted against a law but have voted for the rule because they wrote the rule in conformance with the law. And then obviously I did have my questions, and if someone is being laid off and it is not part of the plan that was set out, obviously they have to come up with a plan, it has to be approved, and if it doesn't fit the criteria that they have in law, and that plan goes against that, they have a way to, as we said before, go to court and say, you didn't even follow your plan here. So I do think there is a way to handle that. So with that, that was the reason that I seconded Senator Hunhoff's motion, and I think that's the way the Rules Committee should vote. Thank you.
Is there any other further brief discussion on the substitute motion? Seeing none, we'll ask the secretary to call the roll. All in favor of the substitute motion will say aye. Those opposed, nay. The secretary will call the roll.
Gibson, aye. Torno.
He said aye.
Aye. What's this for?
This is on the substitute motion. Senator Valley votes no, if I understand correctly.
That's correct.
Hunhoff? No.
Hunt?
No. I believe the vote was 3-2, therefore the substitute motion fails, and that means we're back on the original motion. Any further brief discussion on the original motion to approve these Career Service Commission rules? Hearing, seeing none, We will ask the secretary to call the roll on the original motion, which was to approve these rules. All those in favor will say aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Gibson? No. Toino?
No.
Valley?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye. I believe, again, the vote was 3-2, therefore the motion carries. These rules are approved. That means we go on to the next set of rules by the Bureau of Personnel, but let me ask staff, do you need to take a break at this time, Chris?
We can go. We can keep going.
All right. We will then move to the Bureau of Personnel rules regarding the repeal of the Governor's Senior Prescription Drug Program of 2003. Will the presenter please come forth and identify themselves and proceed with their remarks?
Representative Hunt, members of the committee, Jeff Bloomberg from the Bureau of Personnel. I think I can be really brief on this one. Back in 2003, the legislature passed a program that Governor Rounds had proposed, which provided for a prescription drug discount card that was given through various pharmacies in South Dakota on a voluntary basis. And that was intended as a interim step until the federal government worked out the details on the federal senior drug program. The program went into effect in 2003 and actually operated for, I think, around 6 months before the federal program was adopted. These rules were part of that process, and this is simply a cleanup from a set of rules that have been on the books and not used for approximately 8 years. So we propose a repeal of 5507, 01, and 02.
Thank you, Mr. Blomberg. Are there any questions by members of the committee of Mr. Blomberg? Seeing none, let's go to any other proponents. Proponents on the Bureau of Personnel rules regarding the Senior Prescription Drug Program of 2003. Any other proponents? Any of the other locations? Seeing none, we'll go to opponents. Are there any opponents? Doug, do you have any opponents there in Pierre?
No, no opponents in Pierre.
Okay, I assume there are no opponents at any other remote locations. Therefore, we will close the hearing to the taking of public testimony on these rules and move to committee discussion and or action.
Representative Hunt.
Representative Turner.
I move approval of this repeal, these rules that repeal the provisions here.
We have a motion to approve. Is there a second?
Second.
Second. We have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Representative Turner.
No.
Any other discussion by members of the committee? Seeing, hearing none, we will go to a vote on approving or adopting these rules. All those in favor will say aye. Those opposed, nay. The secretary will call the roll.
Gibson?
Aye.
Toino?
Turno's aye.
Aye.
Sorry.
Valley?
Aye.
Hunthoff?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye. The motion having carried, these rules are therefore approved for adoption. We now move to the Department of Labor and Regulation rules, amending unemployment compensation rules. And at this time, would ask the presenter for these rules to come forward, identify themselves, and proceed with your presentation. Thank you.
Representative Hunt, good morning. My name is Don Katke, representing the Department of Labor and Regulation. And the you have 10 rules in front of you for your consideration this morning. Several of them delete obsolete provisions. Others make amendments to various provisions. And let me quickly just go through them. The first one on your list is 4706-0208, which is on page 8 of the rules that you have in front of you. That rule defines what's called a computation date, And that's a date and time that identifies the dollar amount balance in an employer experience rating account, and that dollar amount is used in turn to set their tax rate. This rule is being deleted, and the reason it is that there was legislation in 2011 that changed the timing on how the employer tax rates were calculated, and as part of that legislation, this computation date definition was included in the statute. So this rule is now in statute, so it's no longer required to be in rule. The second one then, 0411, is on page 4 of the rules that you received. And this is an amendment to a rule that addresses individuals that whether or not they have to look for new work when they're filing for unemployment insurance benefits. And the general rule is that applicants that are receiving unemployment benefits have to, in their unemployment period, look for and accept new work. And there are exceptions to that rule for individuals in certain situations. And the proposed amendment here changes the criteria that we use to decide if people have to look for work or not. And the change is that the current rule says if a worker was employed by a company that is paying most of the unemployment and they're going to be recalled to full-time work, they're simply exempt from the requirement to look for other work in the interim. And that traditionally that has worked pretty well. But what we discovered during the most recent recession is a number of claims that people filed for unemployment. They expected to be recalled to work. Their employer, in good faith, I'm sure, expected them to be recalled. But they went months and months and months and never were recalled to work. And in this period, then, they did not look for other work. They were not required to. And at the end of their unemployment, their claims were exhausted. They had no source of income. They had no other employment. They had no other training in other types of occupations. And it may well have been that other employers could have used their services during this time period. So the amendment here changes this and narrows it down just a bit. And the new language will say that these type of workers are exempt from seeking other work if, due to weather-related seasonal factors, work is not available in their primary occupation and no other work is available for them. So the workers that can't find other jobs because there's simply no work available for them, and I'm thinking like maybe cement finishers or scraper operators that there's no work in the winter, they will continue to be exempt. And other workers like truck drivers, they would have to look for other work if there's other work typically available. And just as a side note, I should note that as a matter of processing, when the department receives these claims, we notify, of course, the last employer always, say, your worker has filed a claim for benefits, do you have any objection? And we also ask them to verify that their workers are on call to return to them before this exemption is granted. The next one on the bottom of page 5, 0411-01, this just clarifies when unemployment claims are effective. Traditionally, claims always work on a calendar week basis. They're effective on Saturday, and they run from a week Saturday through Sunday. And that, again, has always worked very well until the Internet started being used for unemployment claims, and all claims now are filed either by Internet or by telephone. And so we have claims filed on Sunday by the Internet, and we've had some cases where it's interpreted that those claims can be retroactive to the prior Sunday. So the amendment to this rule just says claims always are run on a Sunday to Saturday. If they're filed by Internet, they're effective that day. If they're filed on Sunday by Internet, they're effective that day. If they're filed later in the week, they're effective on the Sunday that starts that week. The next three rules, 4706-0412 on page 5, 0413 on page 6, 0414 also on page 6, all concern in-person reporting to a local employment office to file claims for unemployment. Traditionally, this had been the case. Applicants had to go to an office to do the paperwork to start their claims. That's no longer the case. Applicants, like I said, all file by telephone or by internet. So these rules that require an in-person report to an office are deleted because they're no longer applicable. The next one, 4706.04.14.01 on page 7, similar. This one had a reference to people having to report to an office in person to file a claim. That language was deleted. The next one, 4706.04.15, reporting to other offices. This one also is amended in part because it referred to people having to go to an office to file a claim. It's also amended because this rule has been on the department books for decades, I think. Years and years ago, for whatever reason, this rule was in place that required that if somebody traveled somewhere else to look for a job, they had to ask for and get permission from the department to make that trip. And again, this seemed like, in the current environment where people travel freely, communicate by internet and cell phones and email, no longer appropriate. So we've amended the rule that just now says if a person moves to a new area, their only obligation is to refile their claim from the area they live in, provide a current address, and register for work at their local employment office if they're required to do that. Two last ones, page 8, effective dates of initial and additional claims, 4706.04.18. The majority of this language was in another rule, and the part that wasn't was added to another rule, so this one is deleted because it's just simply no longer necessary. And the last rule then is the defines the criteria for what's actively seeking work, which is 4706.04.21 on page 9. Again, this rule applies to the people that do not have a work attachment for any employer. Their obligation when they're filing for claims is to register for work and be out seeking work on their own initiative. And this rule defines how that work search has to be done in sort of general terms. And the reason this is being amended is the rule required that people make in-person contacts with employers. Well, in discussions with our local managers, about 3/4 of employers no longer want people coming unannounced to their places of business, and in most cases won't even talk to applicants that come in that fashion. They want an email or a resume, some form of electronic communication before they sit down with an interview. So our amendment to Section B of this rule just says that claimants must make the job contact in the manner customarily required by the employer. So if you're an employer and you want your applicants to send you a resume, and that's where you're filing for unemployment, that's where you look for work, you send a resume. If the company you go to wants you to show up in person to hand them an application, that's what your requirement is. It's you look for work in the way the employers you contact, you expect their applicants to look for work. And that's all I have, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Kathy. Are there any questions? Any questions by members of the committee? Seeing none, are there any other proponents of these rules on unemployment? Any other proponents? Let's go to opponents. Are there any opponents to these Department of Labor and Regulation rules on unemployment compensation? Are there any opponents? Seeing, hearing none, we will close the committee hearing to the taking of public testimony and move to committee discussion and or action on these rules.
Mr. Chairman, I move due pass on these rules.
Representative Gibson moves due pass. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Senator Hunhoff. Any discussion? Representative Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think they were very explicitly presented to the committee, and there was no opposition to these rules. They seem like they're common sense, and I think we should move to pass these rules. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion to approve will say aye. Those opposed, nay. The secretary will call the roll.
Gibson?
Aye.
Tornow?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Motion carries.
The rules have been approved. And at that point, we'll move to transfer the gavel to Senator Valley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll now go to the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks. They have some rules for us that go everything from non-resident big game licenses to establishing the new air gun requirements to the limit on Canadian geese to whether you got to have a tag for a mounted animal, or and also the emergency rule on paddlefish. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Light.
Thank you, Senator Valley, and good morning to members of the Rules Committee. My name is Tony Life. I'm Director of the Wildlife Division for the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks. I'm here this morning to present to you the rules that were adopted by the Game, Fish, and Parks Commission at their meeting on June 2nd. That meeting was originally scheduled to be held down in Yankton, a two-day meeting, but as you, most of you might recall, early June was a pretty tumultuous time in the state, and due to some of all the flooding activities, the commission rescheduled that meeting to be a teleconference on June 2nd. It was a one-day meeting. During that one-day teleconference meeting, there were a number of items that were addressed by the commission, and the result of the actions taken by the commission are a rather lengthy package of rule changes that I will try to briefly explain, and would certainly welcome any questions or comments that any committee members might have upon completion of that of the rule presentation. Senator Valley, a question: would you like me to go through the paddlefish thing at the same time, or wait for the rules that need action?
Why don't we just go do those, and then we'll come back to paddlefish.
Okay, thank you, sir. Well, that's the way we'll do it then. The items that the commission took action on at their meeting were, first off, on page one of the package, it was during the 2010 legislative session that a bill was passed to allow landowners to get free antlerless deer licenses on their property. The one responsibility that they placed upon the commission with passage of that bill was that the commission should decide where those licenses should be valid. During the hunting season during 2010, rules were put into place that allowed anybody or landowners that wanted these licenses could hunt in these special areas. And those licenses were allocated specifically within the East River deer hunting season and the West River deer hunting season. It came to our attention through some of our landowners that they wouldn't mind having the opportunity to utilize those licenses within some of the other deer hunting seasons that we have available in the state, in particular the archery, the muzzleloader, and the youth hunting seasons. So what you see here before you is this first rule is to establish a process by which those free antlerless licenses can be issued to eligible landowners, farmers, for use during any of these deer seasons, rather than only being used for either the West River or the East River deer hunting season. In a few minutes here, you're going to see where this similar language to what we have that the commission passed here on page one is being repealed from the West River deer hunting season section, and then later on in another month when I appear before you to discuss the East River deer hunting season, you'll also see where this similar language is repealed from those individual chapters pertaining to those hunting seasons. Next, we'll move on to page four, where you will note that there are some fee adjustments that were being made for all non-resident deer and antelope hunting licenses that have a buck component to them. This change was made by the commission for two reasons. The first of those reasons is we did an analysis after it was brought to our attention by our resident hunters that our non-resident licenses were underpriced. And in particular, if you look at neighboring states and what they get for a non-resident buck hunting licenses in those states, that we were quite a bit behind those. Secondly, anytime we look at a fee increase, we have to talk about the revenue side of that picture, and the question's always asked, what are you going to do with that additional revenue that would be generated from this change? As you will note later on in this package, and you might recall from the last time I appeared before you, and then again when I appear before you here in another month, you're going to see that across the state, we have been successful in achieving some deer and antelope, deer and elk management objectives to reduce some populations. In addition, we have had some reduction in populations in particular our antelope population to the point where we are reducing the number of licenses available. When you pull all this information together, it comes up to a point where this action that the commission took to increase these non-resident license fees is a neutral, a revenue neutral impact on the revenue that we're generating for the department. These license fees that you see increasing here would generate just under $500,000 in revenue, and it's approximately $475,000 worth of revenue that we are anticipating we will not collect due to some of those adjustments in numbers of licenses for other big game hunting seasons. So in effect, the end result is it's a revenue neutral action, and it does bring our fees for these particular licenses more in line with neighboring states and the opportunity that non-residents do have to hunt big game in South Dakota. Next, on page 8, you'll notice where the commission adopted minimum specifications for air guns and hunting. It was during the 2011 legislative session where you and your fellow legislators passed a bill that allowed air guns to be used in the course of hunting. Again, a part of that legislation was direction to the commission to adopt rules to set these minimum standards. Those minimum standards are for a minimum muzzleable velocity of 1,000 feet per second, and it also delineates that only hunting pellets. There are certain pellets that have the ballistics to make them more lethal, or hunting pellets, and only those hunting pellets may be used. Next, at the bottom of page 8 is the beginning of the fall turkey changes. The only changes within the fall turkey hunting season are in the number of licenses that will be issued for the different units. I guess one to bring your attention to, I won't go through all of them, but on the top of page 9 you'll notice that the Black Hills unit, which does get a lot of attention, it does show a significant decrease in the number of licenses that are going to be available for the Black Hills. That number will decrease from 5,000 down to 3,000. The fall turkey hunting season is a population reduction season, and we utilize that in places where we deal with turkey depredation and adjust licenses accordingly based on trying to meet turkey population management objectives. The rest of the individual license changes, once again, a few may go up. More generally, they're going down. Although they do, we do have some moving in different directions, and I could certainly attempt to answer any questions you might have on individual units, but won't spend any time explaining all those adjustments within the license numbers within all those units. That brings us up to page 12, which is the August management take. This is a goose hunting season. In essence, by federal standards, it's not actually a hunting season. It is a management take, and what it allows us to do is target resident Canada geese in the eastern part of the state that do cause depredation problems on farmers' crops. There are two changes in this particular section of hunting that would add three counties to the area open to the August management take: Hanson, Lincoln, and Union counties, which are areas where we are experiencing increasing numbers of depredation issues with Canada geese. And then the second change is on to page 16, where the possession limit for Canada geese will be removed. This action was taken specifically to allow us to work with the Fish and Wildlife Service to hopefully implement a similar program like we have for antlerless deer in the state. And that's what to cooperate with our Sportsmen Against Hunger program to get some of these geese donated and get it into the food bank system and provide some necessary protein to individuals that don't have sufficient protein in their diet. So we're still working with the Fish and Wildlife Service on that. Stay tuned. We're hoping to implement that, and we are actually fairly sure that if we can get that all pulled together, that we will have a beneficial harvest. I think we think we'll have some additional harvest due to having that provision in place, and then also, again, be able to provide that secondary benefit of some of that meat to needy families that could use it. Next, on page 17, would be the Black Hills deer hunting season. The only changes that were made to the Black Hills deer hunting season were adjustments with the licenses, numbers and types that would be issued. But a particular note here is the elimination of antlerless licenses in almost all units. There'd be the only unit in the Black Hills deer hunting season that would still have any antlerless tags available would be the Northern Black Hills, that unit that's up in that Spearfish area, where we still have a few more deer than we would like to have, and we want to manage those downward. The rest of the Black Hills, there will be no antlerless deer tags issued. And you're also going to see this similar type rule passage by the commission when we get to the archery, muzzleloader, and youth hunting seasons. Next is the West River deer hunting season that begins on page 21 of your package. A number of different license allocations or numbers of licenses issued that are generally in a downward trend in certain counties or certain units in the western part of the state. We are seeing fruits to our efforts to reduce the deer numbers and consequently are reducing some deer license numbers in some of those units. A particular interest in the West River deer hunting season was a pretty substantial change that was made by the commission. We brought before the commission a recommendation to implement three experimental, if you will, units where the composition of those hunting units is going to be only public land. We have some experience with this particular concept up in Dewey County. We have a unit that's called the Little Moreau Game Production Area where it's a small unit, but it's all public land, and the hunters that apply for that unit tell us that it works very well for them, that they really enjoy the limited opportunity, because if you have a regular Dewey County license outside of the Little Moreau unit, you can't go in there and hunt. So it really limits the number of hunters that goes onto these public lands and hunts, and ends up resulting in a better opportunity for those few that can hunt on that property by drawing one of these limited issue licenses. There would be three of these additional hunting units that would be established under the rules adopted by the commission. One of those would be in Fall River County on the Hill Ranch Game Production Area and some associated Forest Service property next to that. Another would be up in Harding County where almost all of the Forest Service property contained within Harding County would be its own hunting unit. And the third of those new experimental limited access units would be in Perkins County, where there would be one of the pastures that's operated by the Grand River National Grassland that would be placed within one of these special hunting units. Got a great deal of comment. We solicited a lot of comment from our hunters, specifically targeted those individuals that had applied for licenses in these units over the past 3 years, because we knew this was a substantial change and that we wanted to get as much input as possible. And we're pleasantly surprised with the response that we got, that the majority of hunters, and it did vary a little bit by each of those units, but by and large, I think most of the hunters recognize that, yes, in the short term, that they may lose an opportunity to go hunting on this public land, but most were recognized that the trade-off of having a better hunt, a better opportunity with less competition on these public land units would be a net positive for them in the end. And in the end, the commission did choose to adopt those units, and it's something that we gave a great deal of discussion to, and the commission adopted those under the pretext that they were experimental and that we were going to take a hard look at how well hunters like those new hunting units before we would either retain them or maybe even expand to additional limited access public hunting units in other areas of the state. The balance of the changes within the West River deer hunting season, again, were pertained directly to the numbers of licenses issued, except for repeal of the rule on page 34 that I mentioned in my initial comments on the areas where those free antlerless deer licenses are available to landowners. As I said, we are repealing that specifically within the West River deer section, although certainly landowners that live in western South Dakota will still be able to purchase the same license that they purchased last year and be able to utilize that license during the West River deer hunting season. It's just that it's placed in a more more encompassing area at the beginning in our general rules to apply to all those seasons instead of specifically to the West River deer hunting season. In the middle of page 34 is the beginning of the archery deer hunting season. There were two changes there that were of substance, first of which would be to change the closing, the season closing date, change that from January 31st to January 15th. There's limited opportunity in the end of January, and one of the things that we've consistently heard from some landowners is that they'd like to see some of those seasons end a little bit sooner. Consequently, the season dates were, the last 2 weeks were peeled off of that to allow that season to close on January 15th. Also notable within the archery deer hunting rules is that antlerless tags were previously valid in the Black Hills region, within the Black Hills Fire Protection District. And the action taken by the commission now restricts that those antlerless deer licenses, none of them are valid for taking antlerless deer within the Black Hills, again, consistent with our goal to reduce the number of antlerless deer that are shot within the Black Hills in the hopes or plans of increasing that deer population from where it's at right now. Also, there were some changes with the refuges. The refuges do allow some archery hunting on their properties, and there were a couple adjustments made after coordination with National Wildlife Refuge staff. On to page 37 would be the archery antelope hunting season. One somewhat minor change there. Antelope numbers have suffered from two very difficult winters this last year, and previously we had issued some three-tag licenses for antelope hunting season during the rifle season, and at that time we had adjusted the archery season so that those hunters also could get a three-tag license. The action taken by the commission would no longer allow three-tag licenses to be issued, and it'd be back to either a single tag or a two-tag license that would be available to archery antelope hunters. Next up would be the youth deer hunting season would be next on page 38. Youth deer hunters could previously two licenses are available to your youth deer hunters, and they can harvest both of those deer in the Black Hills in previous years. The action taken by the commission would still allow them to have two licenses, but only one of those licenses would be valid for harvesting antlerless deer in the Black Hills. All of the youth deer hunting licenses are antlerless deer only, and what this prohibition would do would reduce the number of deer that are again being shot in the Black Hills. The staff recommendation and the commission action did concur with, we wanted to still allow for that youth deer hunting opportunity in the Black Hills. So this is one area where there are some antlerless tags available, and the youth would be the only ones, again, that could hunt in the Black Hills for these antlerless deer. Next is the muzzleloader deer hunting season, and you'll notice, again, a similar theme there, that previously those muzzleloader hunters could harvest antlerless deer in the Black Hills, but under the changes adopted by the commission, they could no longer do that. Also, there are areas of the state where antlerless deer are taking of antlerless deer is restricted. Instead of being able to use these statewide licenses throughout the state, there are sections of the state where we want to only allow limited harvest of antlerless deer under the muzzleloader license. And Yankton County was added to that list of areas where muzzleloader could only shoot one antlerless deer with the antlerless tags, unlike the rest of those counties where multiple antlerless deer can be harvested with those muzzleloader licenses. At the bottom of page 39 are fur bearer seasons. There was a somewhat innocuous or the language in there about Sand Lake and National Wildlife Refuges being open to trapping. Essentially, that's a land access issue. The refuges have that ability to restrict access onto those refuges, and it's not necessary to have in rule any provision for a special season on those areas. Consequently, that language was removed by the commission. On to the bobcat trapping season, trapping and hunting season at the bottom of page 40. There's some cleanup language there to change extension trapper to wildlife damage specialist. That's what we call our previously known as extension trappers. They're damage specialists now. The notable change or the substantive change within that is that bobcat hunters and trappers are required to provide a 24-hour notice if they have any bobcats in their possession after the season closes. They subsequently must submit those for tagging within 5 days, but the desire here is to ensure that those trappers and hunters are done taking those animals and that they give notification to the department after the season closes that they have an additional the additional number of bobcats that they have in possession that still need to be tagged. At the bottom of page 41, there is a provision put into place that these body grip traps that are in accordance with the rule that states that there's a size limit on these particular body grip traps. If they're 8 inches or larger, they are potentially dangerous, in particular to hunting dogs and other animals, but they need to be placed underwater. And previously, those sets could not be made in these counties for beaver in west of the Missouri River. And the change was requested by our trapping community, and the change was made by the commission to allow these particular traps to be placed in the water west of the Missouri River. The last section I have to present to you this morning has to do with shooting preserves, and this again is follow-up to legislation that was passed during the 2011 session. Mostly what you'll notice here is substitution of the word permittee for operator. This is to ensure that the compliance with laws and rules pertaining to shooting preserves, the burden of following those laws and rules is placed upon the individual that holds the permit, because occasionally a permittee may hire someone to operate their shooting preserve, and there needs to be clarity that the onus of cooperation and compliance with laws and rules falls upon the individual that holds the permit. There is one other substantive changes within that, and it's on page 46 of your rule package, and that's to note that only new preserve permittees are required to attend the training of them. Individuals that have had preserves in past years were previously required to always attend this training. It's not necessary. I think a number of them still come just to as a refresher, but the only requirement would be for new preserve permittees to appear before or in that that training session. Mr. Chairman, that's a summation of my comments. I would be happy to stand by for any questions of committee.
Are there any questions by the committee for Mr. Light?
Mr. Chair, I have a few.
Is that Senator Hunhoff?
Of course. I wouldn't let Mr. Life go away so easily. I have a question. Included in the packet was a financial for the total fiscal impact. When you were before appropriations for your budget, was this increase and decrease part of your budgetary package?
Is Senator Hunoff, those adjustments were not known at that time, and so no, they were not included as a part of the presentation that was made to the Appropriations Committee.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
So there's additional dollars. I'm a little confused in your numbers and what you said, and I'm assuming that we're waiting for East River data when you set all that there will be increases and reductions in non-residents and residents in those areas?
That's correct, Senator Hunoff. In fact, I can give you the specific numbers that the Commission has already adopted as far as some adjustments within those licenses. For the elk hunting season, there will be a reduction of $26,000 in revenue. The Black Hills deer hunting season, there will be a reduction in $35,000 in revenue. The West River deer, there will be a reduction of $88,000 in revenue. The fall turkey, there will be a reduction of $24,000 in revenue. Those are all rule changes that you've seen already. The rules that were just adopted by the Commission last week pertain to antelope, East River deer, and the antelope reduction that you'll see here in the numbers in license reductions are $215,000. In reduced license fees that we're going to collect there. And for East River deer, the reduction will be just under $70,000 of license reductions.
Follow up. Will there be any increases from the, are you going to do non-resident increases on East River also?
The fees do apply to all deer and antelope licenses that are valid for taking a buck. So if it's a single tag or a double tag, any plus an errant list, or a triple tag, I don't think we have any of those any longer, but it's still in rule that way. Those non-resident license fees would apply to any non-resident that purchased those licenses. Now it's important to note that no allocation of East River deer hunting licenses are made, and there are very rare, if any, buck licenses that are sold for hunting during the East River deer hunting season, because residents end up purchasing all those before a leftover license situation comes around and non-residents are then eligible to purchase those licenses.
Thank you. Can I have one more question, please?
Go ahead.
Unrelated to finances. On your experimental units where it's only public hunting, is that resident or non-resident accessible for licenses?
In all three of those hunting units, there is a 8% allocation for non-residents. So in the case of Harding County, there are 200 resident licenses that would be issued for that public land in Harding County. And in addition, there would be 16 non-resident licenses available for that same hunting unit.
Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Light? I have one quick one on the preserves. If they're a new permittee, so let's say that I own a preserve, but I have another person running it now, does that new person have to come? Or since I'm the same owner, then you get the drift of my question?
Sure. It pertains only to the permittee. So if the individual held the permit in the previous year, the requirement would not be in place for them. Certainly if there's situations where a new operator is in place for a permittee, we would encourage them to attend, but it's a good point. You know, if they switch operators, I would hope that the permittee would see it fit to get them to the training, because it's not restricted only to new permittees, just required of new permittees.
You may want to think about that if you see some things develop.
So Good point. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other proponents for these rules? Any other proponents? Last call for proponents. Are there any opponents to these rules? Any opponents? Last call for opponents. Last call for questions. If there are none, we will close it to public testimony and open it up for comments or action by the committee.
Representative Hunt, move approve.
Have a motion from Representative Hunt to approve.
Second, Representative Gibson.
A second from Representative Gibson. It's been moved and seconded. All those, is there any discussion on those, on that motion?
No, no, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
There is no discussion on that. The secretary will call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay.
Gibson?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Swarno?
Aye.
Budhoff?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye. Now we'll go to Mr. Life, and he will explain to us the reason for the paddlefish emergency change.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Tony Life, Director of the Wildlife Division. Last week, the Game Fish and Parks Commission took action to suspend or cancel the archery paddlefish season along the Missouri River. The area that's open to taking of paddlefish is that area south of Gavin's Point Dam in Yankton on down to the confluence with the Big Sioux River. We essentially have a shared population of paddlefish, since that's a boundary water, that we cooperate with Nebraska to establish the harvest guidelines for that population of paddlefish. The primary method used for taking those paddlefish is, at least with the archery season, is from a boat. And currently, all boating is restricted in that stretch of the river where paddlefish can be found. Previous to the action by the Game Fish and Parks Commission, the Nebraska Game and Parks Commission also took action to cancel their paddlefish, archery paddlefish season that's set to occur in this same period. Prior to this action, we sent notice to all 275 successful applicants for the season. We did hear back from two of them that they were disappointed with the action or the pending action that the commission was going to take, expressing the desire to possibly hunt paddlefish, if you call it. I'm not sure if it's hunting or fishing, but to attempt to take these paddlefish from shore with their bows. You know, that was something the commission gave some consideration to, but in the end felt like the safety element of this and the lack of a more consistent reply. Again, there were only two individuals, one of them that was very adamant, and a second one, I think, that essentially said, me too. But the commission did take action to close the archery paddlefish season. It would not be the intention of the commission to initiate rulemaking process to make this change permanent. Consequently, I believe it's after 90 days, Mr. Decker, after 90 days, this change that was adopted by the commission by emergency rule action would revert back to the original form, and pending additional action next year, we would have the same paddlefish season for archery fishermen that they did in previous years. Be happy to answer any questions they might have.
Are there any questions for Mr. Life on the paddlefish emergency rule? If there are none, we thank you.
Thank you.
We'll now move to the Department of Transportation, and Mr. Navin from the Department of Transportation is back there. So, did I say Navin? Sorry.
Thank you, Senator Valley. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I have five speed zone rules to present to the committee today. The first one is on Interstate I-90, and this is Rule 7001-02-00-1. And this is in conjunction with the recently completed construction of the new Marion Road interchange, which is exit 395. This proposed rule would create a slowed down 65 mile an hour speed zone as you're approaching that new exit 395, and then it would extend on through exit 396, which is the interchange between I-90 and I-29. The second rule is in conjunction with a new rule. This is 7001-02-00-4, and on Interstate 229, We reconstructed that area near the junction with Interstate 90 and then on north to Minnehaha County Road 125. This rule, together with a due rule, which would be 70.01.02.00(5), would create a 55 mile an hour step down speed zone at the approaches to the I-90 ramps and then to the existing County Road 125. The fourth rule would be a proposed repeal of 70.01.02.01(5), which is a segment of road on 229 that is now would now be covered by these two rules that I just previously spoke of. And so this rule would no longer be needed. And the final rule I have is 70.01.02.32(1). And this is in Hamlin County on State Highway 38 in the town of Lake Norton, beginning a third of a mile east of the junction with State Highway 21, and then going east through town, it would lower the speed limit from 55 to 50 miles an hour to slow traffic down a little bit next to commercial and residential areas and in those curves near Lake Norton and Lake Mary. The first four rules concerning the interstate were all proposed by the Mitchell region of SDOT, and local law enforcement and officials concurred. The department did not receive any public comment on any of those rules. The Hamlin County rule was initiated by the Aberdeen region office of the Department of Transportation, again with the concurrence of law enforcement and local officials. And again, no public comments were received on that proposed rule change. With that, Mr. Or Senator Valley, I would stand by for any questions the committee might have.
Are there any questions by the committee on the speed limit change rules? Any questions by the committee? If not, are there any further proponents of these rules? Any further proponents? Last call for proponents. Are there any opponents to these rules? Any opponents? Last call for opponents. At that point, we will close this to public testimony and open it up to committee discussion and or action.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gibson, I move do pass, please.
The move by Representative Gibson to do pass. Is there a second?
Representative Hunt, second.
It's been seconded by Representative Hunt. Any comments on that motion?
No, none for me. Thank you.
If there are no comments on that motion, the Secretary will call the roll. Those in favor of these rules will say aye. Those opposed say nay.
Gibson?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Torino?
No.
Valley?
Aye.
Unhoff?
Aye.
The motion carries and the rules will be approved as written. With that, I turn the gavel back over to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. First, I want to say thank you to everyone for your patience and indulgence in our late start, and I assume you have no department people or any that provided testimony. I thank them for their patience with us. Mr. Decker, I'd ask you if you had a staff report. You said no. Our next meeting is scheduled for when?
The next meeting, Madam Chairman, is Tuesday, August 30th. It's a DDN meeting also. We're scheduled to start at 8:55 a.m. We have, at this time, 10 sets of rules to review.
Now, this is DDN, I take it. Can we have some assurance that we'll get this system working and we can start on time?
I certainly hope so.
All right, good. I'm glad to hear that. You know, is there anything else from committee members?
Yeah. See, I had a question in Sioux Falls, and maybe it came up before I got here, but I think everybody checked our agenda, and we were supposed to be at a different location. Did we miss an email or did something happen?
This is Chris. It's always been scheduled for the University Center
all of our DDN sites for rules are scheduled there. They may have moved you to a different room today.
They moved us to a different location. We're about 2 miles away from where we were supposed to be. You had a 2205 Career Avenue, room 282. We're at like 145 North Career Avenue. It's about 2 miles away.
That was not my information that I had. I apologize.
Chris, I think that might have been in-house University Center move, because when I checked into this particular building, they told me that they had now designated this room 145, as the DDN Center. That sounded to me like that's just been done in the last couple of weeks or so. So maybe somebody can check with DDN and find out if they've updated their information.
I apologize. I was out of the office last week for about 3 days and came back to an email yesterday morning asking if we could change, and they asked how many people we expected. We told them it could be anywhere from 2 to 15, and they said, we'll leave you where you're at.
No problem. You just might want to check the DDN, because I think they have maybe changed their permanent location to this room 145.
So we're clear, Chris, so you know, we're at, they sent us up to a building 4801 Career Avenue North.
Okay, I'll check on it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Anything else? Well, with that, I would then say thank you and entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Representative Hunt, seconded by Representative Gibson. Do we need to do a voice vote on that, Chris?
Oh, I suppose.
All right. Gibson? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Gibson?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Torno?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye. Motion carried. Again, thank you, everyone, for your patience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you much.
Thank you. Have a good month in between.
Luther's.